That's what nature is, really, getting food. And when you're out here having to live, you look for food. Food first. Food. Food. They moved through the day that way. During mid-morning, they found some raspberries growing in a bush pile. It was not a thick stand. It would maybe have been enough for one person, but with two it was skimpy. Still, there were some, and they worked through the brush in their underwear, eating every berry they could find. They also found some choke cherries, what Brian had called gut cherries, but Brian shook his head. Later if we have to, and then in small amounts. Brian kept moving along the lake, waiting, walking, and waiting, and he realized at length what he was waiting for, what was in the back of his mind. Luck. You move, and you watch, and you work hard, and you just keep doing that until luck comes. If it's bad luck, you ride it out. And if it comes the other way and you have good luck, you're ready for it. They had good luck in the middle of the afternoon, and as so often seems to happen, the good luck came about because of bad luck. Brian had moved out ahead, down and to the right of Derek, and was working closer to the edge of the lake. Derek worked up and away from the lake, looking for more berries as they moved. "Stay inside of me," Brian had told him. "Don't get away from the lake so far that you can't see. And if you run into a bear, don't look into his eyes." "Bear?" "They hunt for food, too, and eat berries. We'll probably see one. Just back away and don't look at them. I read that it's a threat when you do that." "Bear?" Brian was glad to see that his warning had been taken and Derek was always within sight. Here the land rose as they approached the northern end of the lake. It came up in a low roll that made a sizable hill next to the lake. Because of this rise and the freezing and thawing of the lake, the movement of the ice each winter, the land had been cut away, washed still further away by heavy rains. Brian could see the work of last night's rain, and all this chewing at the side of the hill had left something close to a small cliff. It wasn't terribly high, 30 feet or so, but it was steep and very unstable, the edge loose and soft from the rain. Brian had moved close to the edge. Down below he could see into the green water of the lake, and there were fish moving, and the sight made him realize how hungry he was becoming. It had been over a day now. They had eaten normally the day before when they flew to the lake, and the hunger was becoming demanding. He turned to see Derek, who was coming up the back of the hill. "See the fish?" Brian had come too close to the soft soil at the edge, and before he could finish the sentence, the bank let go. He dropped like an anvil, his finger still pointing at the fish. Halfway down the face of the cut, there was a small outcropping of soil and rocks mixed, held in place because it was made of clay and chalk bound together, and Brian hit this mound on his stomach hard. Oof! He heard himself sound like the air going out of a tire. Then he bounced up and sideways and continued on down to the bottom in a shower of mud and rocks to where a small gravel beach led into the lake. "I don't think I'll move," he thought, lying flat on his face, "ever again." Derek was by his side in moments, frowning in worry. "Are you hurt?" "I wonder why people ask that," Brian thought. "Did he think I could do this and not hurt?" But he shook his head. "No, at least I don't think so." He rose or put his hands down to push himself up, and as he made the move, he noticed the rocks around him on the beach. Most of them were round and smooth, rubbled by wind and water and weather and time, but mixed in with them were black, hardened shards. Where he'd fallen, there were fresh ones, not weathered, and he saw that they had come from the bank where he had bounced. "Look," Brian held up one of the black stones. It was chipped and layered. "I think it might be the same kind of stone I used to make fire with the hatchet." "Flint," Derek said. "I think it is." Brian took out his knife, opened it, and locked the blade, and struck the back of the hard steel against the sharp edge of the flint. 3-4 times he hit, and finally there were sparks. He looked up, smiling. No more mosquitoes. He took 2 of the larger black stones, and they went to find a campsite. And here, too, there was the waiting for luck. They walked nearly halfway around the lake, looking always as well for food. As they worked past the northern end of the lake, they came on low brush filled with small nuts. These he knew were hazelnuts, and they stopped to pick and eat some. They were ripe or very close, just shy of being dry, and the worms and squirrels had been at them, but they still found enough to cut the edge off their hunger. They used rocks to smash them and spent over an hour bashing rocks and nibbling at the small chunks of nut meat, which tasted almost sweet. It was then approaching evening, and Brian knew they would need a shelter of some kind and a fire before dark and the evening horde of insects found them. Then, coming out of a stand of thick willows, they found it. In some ancient time, an enormous tree had fallen in a giant wind. The tree had been growing on the side of a small hill, which was made on a rocky shelf. As the tree went over, it pulled earth, balled in its roots with it, and made a large hole back in under the shelf of rocks. Time had done the rest. The tree was long rotted and gone to worms. The soil had filtered somewhat back into the hole and taken grass seeds, and what was left was a large depression in the side of the hill with an overhanging shelf of rock. On each side of the depression there were large trees, white pines that went towering up and shaded the whole place to make it feel like a quiet garden. It was not perfect, not as nice as Brian had had on the L-shaped lake, but it was good enough, far better than nothing, and to cap it off, there was a small spring of water to the side of the overhang where a fissure of rock let water work out in a trickle that made its way down to the lake. "Home," Brian said. Derek looked at the depression. "It looks like a hole. What do we do to make it livable?" "Beds and a fire. You use pine boughs to make the beds." He showed Derek how to cut the boughs and stick them point down to make a soft bed. "You do that and I'll work on a fire."
"I need to watch you do that," Derek said, "so I can write about it."
Brian nodded and set out to find what he needed. He would never forget the first fire, what it had meant to him, as important as it must have been to early man, and he approached making a fire now almost as a religious experience. You could not hurry it, he knew. Fire would come only when it wanted to come, and only when there was a good bed for it, a home for it. He found some birches near the shoreline and shredded dry birch bark with his fingernails until it was like hair. He kept adding to this until he had a ball of fluff 3 inches in diameter. To this he added some pulverized dried grass, worked almost into flour, and when it was all together he gently used his finger to make a hole in the middle. A home for the fire, he thought, a place for it to live. Derek had watched all of this with intense interest, writing in his notebook from time to time, underlining things, nodding. Brian set aside the tinder and found some dry pine twigs, as small as matches. When he had a good pile of these broken and lined up for use, he searched for slightly larger dry wood, and still larger until he had a pile as high as his knees. In all of this, he was silent, thinking only of the fire. But he turned to Derek now. "You can't have too much wood, ever. And you should always have dried wood stashed back in some safe place along with tinder." He paused, thinking, remembering.
"What is it?" Derek asked.
"Fire. It's so alive. Such an important thing to us. Back there in the world, we don't know that. But when I got home last time, I tried to read about what it was like, you know, before we got everything we have now. In colonial times, they kept people awake just to watch the fires, and in ancient times, the most important person in the tribe was called the fire watcher." Derek wrote it down, and Brian smiled. Something about Derek walking around all day looking for berries and nuts, carrying a briefcase like a business executive, seemed ridiculous. But he meant what he was doing, and Brian liked him more and more all the time. When he'd fallen and Derek had kneeled next to him, he had been genuinely worried.
Fire.
There was the lowering of light now, and evening would not be long, accompanied by the waiting bugs. He and Derek made a small fire pit in front of the overhang. Then Brian put the tinder on the ground in the pit so that the flame cup was aimed upward. Over this he held the piece of flint. He struck it with the knife, and nothing came. Naturally, he thought, if it were easy, everybody would want to do this. He hit again and again, and finally the sparks came. Now he slammed the stone with the back of the knife blade with renewed force again and again until a small shower of sparks fell into the cup. Quickly he raised the tinder in his hand, blowing gently, softly on the sparks, watching as they became glowing holes in the tinder, and the holes grew, became red, turned to coals, and finally, blowing as he put it back on the ground, smoke curling up into his eyes, there came the tiny flicker of new flame. Hello, he thought. Hello, flame. Fire. He fed small twigs to the flame, crossing them and recrossing them until the fire was full, healthy. Then he added larger sticks and still larger until they filled the pit and there was the crackling sound of a full fire. Brian settled back on his haunches and smiled, looked up at Derek, who was also smiling. Brian gestured around with his hand. No more mosquitoes. The smoke keeps them away. It doesn't even take much, just a little blowing around. But we need more wood. It took the next hour to gather wood, stacking it until they had a large pile to the side of the camp, and Derek used the time to cut pine boughs for beds as well. When it was late and they finally lay back to rest, they had done much to make the overhang a home. Brian went to sleep on his side. The last thing he heard before he dozed was the sound of a wolf. He heard Derek rise. "It's a wolf," Brian said, "far away, just singing. Besides, wolves don't bother you. You can go back to sleep." And Derek did, rolling over, his breathing even, and Brian let sleep come again. Brian stood away from the fish trap and shook his head. Nothing was the same, really. It was a beautiful day, with the mid-afternoon sun shining down on them, and he thought of what the problem could be, what was wrong. It had somehow turned into one big happy camping trip. We might as well have a cooler full of soft drinks and sandwiches, Brian thought. They'd been at the lake 3 days, but it looked like they'd been there a year. The camp was squared away and neat. Derek had called in on the radio and told the world they were all right, telling them to pass the information on to Brian's parents. Brian thought his mother might worry if she knew about them sending the gear back. Then they had enhanced the beds and made them deep and soft with more boughs. There was enough firewood for a month, and they had made birch bark containers to hold extra hazelnuts and berries. They'd found blueberries and raspberries and plums. On this side of the lake, the forest was more open, and the plums and nuts and berries seemed to thrive in the light and heat. Wild plums. They were a little green, but even so, Brian couldn't believe how sweet and rich they were, like small domestic plums with a little more tang to them. Brian had made a bow, used a strip from his belt for a string, and had showed Derek how to shoot fish, then how to use the guts from one fish to bait the others into a trap made of stones. And they soon had more fish than they needed. Brian found a clam bed, and they had actually eaten one meal, clams steamed around the fire, nuts and berries, that left them full. Full. Plus they had more clams stored and plenty of fish left in the trap, and knew the locations of several ruffed grouse. There were rabbits and squirrels all over the place, and if they had to, they could make it a year or two. And it felt wrong. All wrong. He shook his head again and moved back by the fire pit. Derek was sitting on his bed by the fire, feeding an occasional stick to the fire to keep it going, writing in his notebook. He looked up as Brian walked into the shelter and saw him shaking his head. "What's the matter?" Brian shrugged. "I don't know. It's just wrong, I think." "What do you mean, wrong?" Brian looked around at the shelter, the comfort, the food, the fire, the lake. All this were so ready, so calm. It doesn't work somehow. None of it works. "I still don't know for sure what you're talking about. We've done it. In 4 days, you've shown me how to live in the wilderness with nothing but a knife. I've got tons of notes to take back and teach from. I think you're wrong." "But this isn't how it works," Brian said. "It isn't this smooth and easy. You don't just fly in and get set on a perfect lake and have all the food you want and have it all come this easy. It isn't real." Derek leaned back, put his hands in back of his head, and looked at Brian. "There's not a thing to make it rough, nothing wrong. In a real situation like when I was here before, there were things wrong, going wrong. The plane didn't land and set me on the shore. It crashed. A man was dead. I was hurt. I didn't know anything. Nothing at all. I was maybe close to death, and now we're out here going la-di-da. I've got a fish, la-di-da, and there are some more berries." "Tension," Derek said. "It lacks tension." Brian nodded. "Maybe, but that's not all. I don't think you can teach what you want to teach."
"But they do. They teach survival."
"No, I think they tell people what to do, and maybe you can tell them some of what we do. But that doesn't teach them how to live, how to do it, does it? You'd have to bring each person here and drop them in the lake and let them swim out and drag up the shore and try to live to really teach them how to do it, every single one."
"But that's impossible."
Brian nodded. "I know, but I don't think it will work unless you do it that way. You can tell, but you can't really teach."
"Tension," Derek said again, leaning forward and writing in his notebook again. "You need the tension created by the emergency."
And they settled in for the rest of the day and that night. And later, Brian would remember what they had said, how it needed tension, and wish he had not thought it at all. Brian awakened suddenly and listened and smelled. For a moment he could not tell what had brought him up from sleep. They had banked the fire well and the coals would last until morning. It was still warm and red, giving off a little smoke. There were no bugs, the night cool wasn't too cold, no animals prowled, and he could find nothing wrong and was closing his eyes to sleep again when he heard it. The far-off sound of thunder. Not loud, low and rumbling. He could smell rain coming, but that should pose no problem. The storms and the wind came from the north-northwest, and they had the hill and back to protect them. With the overhang facing south and being on the side of the hill, the rain wouldn't bother them. In fact, they'd had an evening of soft rain, and nothing had come in the shelter, not a drop. And with the storm blowing any rain away from the opening, they should stay dry and safe. Brian put a couple of pieces of wood on the fire to make sure it kept going, added a handful of green leaves to make smoke and keep the mosquitoes down, checked to see that Derek was still sleeping and lay back on his bed. Maybe the storm wouldn't even hit them. He remembered the tornado that had caught him before and decided he wouldn't worry. The odds against getting hit twice by anything as wild as a tornado were huge, and there was nothing they could do anyway, except just hope that it would miss them. He remembered the sound the tornado had made, the wild roaring, and the storm it had come from, and this was different. A summer rainstorm with soft thunder. It didn't seem anything to worry about, and certainly nothing to keep him awake. He went back to sleep, slipping into a light doze. Things moved in and out. He dreamed that he was talking to Derek, saying in the dream that he thought that they should use the radio to call the plane and cancel the rest of the operation, as Derek kept calling it in the dream, because it didn't seem to prove anything. He was awakened by an explosion. It seemed to come from inside his skull, inside his thinking, inside the dream. A sharp crack so loud that he snapped awake, rolled over, and was on his feet moving to the back of the shelter without thinking, without knowing he was moving. It was thunder, but not like he'd heard before, not like he'd ever heard. It was around them, exploding around them, the lightning cracking around the shelter so close it seemed to Brian that it came from inside him. What? He knew that he opened his mouth, that he made sound, but he could hear nothing except the whack crack of the thunder, see nothing but images frozen in the split instants of brilliance from the lightning. Like a camera taking pictures by a strobe light, things would seem frozen in time, caught and frozen, and then there would be another flash and things would be different. Derek was moving. In one flash, he was still on his bed, but raised, his jacket falling away from where he'd had it as a blanket as he rose. Darkness. Then the next flash of light and he was on his knees. Darkness. Then he was leaning forward and his hand was out, reaching for his briefcase and radio next to the bed, one finger out, his face concentrating. And Brian thought, no, don't reach, stay low. And he might have yelled it, screamed it, but it didn't matter. No sound could be loud enough to get over the thunder. There was a slashing, new, impossibly loud crack as lightning seemed to hit the shelter itself, and Brian saw the top of the pine next to the opening suddenly explode, and felt saw the bolt come roaring down the tree, burning and splittering the wood and bark, and he saw it hit Derek. Camera image. Something. Some blueness of heat and light and raw power seemed to jump from the tree to the briefcase and radio and enter Derek's hand. All in the same part of a second, it hit him and his back arched, snapped him erect, and then it seemed to fill the whole shelter and slammed into Brian as well. He saw the blueness, almost a ball of energy, the crack flash of color that came from inside his mind, inside his life, and then he was back and down. And saw nothing more. Before his eyes opened, there was light through the eyelids, bright light, but they didn't want to open and focus. He tasted things, smelled things. Something was burned. There was the stink of something burned. Hair. Burned hair. It smelled awful. He opened his eyes wide, blinked, forced them to work, and saw that he was on his back, looking at the stone-layered ceiling of the overhang. It was daylight, broad daylight, and he wondered why it was that he would be lying on his back, on the dirt, looking at the ceiling in the middle of the day. Then he remembered. Parts of it, the sound, the light, the thunder, and the slamming and cracking of it, and he was afraid. He did not know what he was afraid of at first. He was just afraid. And then, finally, he remembered Derek. It had hit him. He had seen it hit Derek. He rolled on his side. His body felt stiff, mashed into the ground, and the sudden movement made his vision blur. There. He saw Derek, or the form of Derek. He was face down on his bed, his right hand out, his left arm back and down his side. Blurred. He was all blurred and asleep. How could he be all blurred? Brian shook his head, tried to focus. Derek was still asleep. How strange, Brian thought. How strange that Derek should still be asleep in the bright daylight. And he knew then that Derek was not sleeping, but did not want to think of the other thing. Let's reason it out, he thought. His mind as blurred as his vision. Reason it all out. Derek was reaching for the radio and briefcase, and the lightning hit the tree next to the shelter and came down the tree and across the air and into Derek, and he fell. No, he was still asleep. He wasn't that other thing, not that other word. But Brian's eyes began to clear then and saw that Derek was lying with his head to the side and that it was facing Brian, and the eyes weren't closed. They were open. He was on his side, not moving, and his eyes were open, and Brian thought how strange it was that he would sleep that way, mashed on his stomach. He knew Derek wasn't sleeping. He knew. No, he couldn't be. Couldn't be dead. Not Derek. Finally, he accepted it. Brian rose to his hands and knees, stiff and with great slowness, and crawled across the floor of the shelter to where Derek lay. The large man lay on his stomach as he dropped, his head turned to the left. The eyes were not fully open, but partially lidded, and the pupils stared blankly, unfocused toward the back of the shelter. Brian touched his cheek. He remembered how when the pilot had his heart attack, he had felt cool. The dead skin had felt cool. Derek's skin did not have the coolness. It felt warm, and Brian kneeled next to him and saw that he was breathing. Tiny little breaths, his chest barely rising and falling, but he was breathing, the air going in and out, and he was not the other word, not dead, and Brian leaned over him. Derek. There was no answer, no indication that Derek had heard him. Derek, can you hear anything I'm saying? Still no sign, no movement. So, Brian thought, so he's what? He's knocked out. He got hit and he's knocked out, and if I wait and make him comfortable, he'll come out of it. That was it, just knocked out. Derek's head looked twisted at an uncomfortable angle, and Brian moved Derek's body onto its side and set his head. The neck felt rubbery and loose on his rolled-up jacket for a pillow. As he did, he saw the briefcase and radio. The radio. There it was, right there on the briefcase, and if there was ever a need for it, it was now. He picked it up, turned the switch on. Katie 1, this is Katie 2, over. His mother's name. It was a small thing, a way to include his mother. They used her name as the call sign, and Derek had shown Brian how to use the radio, the correct procedure in case of an emergency. Like now. Katie 1, this is Katie 2, over. Nothing. He turned the squelch control down and listened for the hiss of static, but there was nothing. Not even noise. Again. Katie 1, this is Katie 2, over. Dead air. He saw then that next to where the antenna came out of the case, there was a small discolored spot on the plastic. It was a burn mark. The radio was made to be used outdoors, tough, with a weatherproof case around it, and when he opened the outside case, he saw that the lightning had hit the radio as well as Derek and him. There was a jagged line burned in the plastic on the back, and even without opening the case and seeing the inside, he knew the radio was blown. What to do? Think. He couldn't think right. He put the radio down and turned back to Derek. There was no change at all. No movement except for the short rise and fall of his chest with his breathing. The eyes were still partially opened as they had been. Think, what did he know that could help? Lightning had hit the tree next to the overhang. Come down the side, he saw where the pine bark was burned and literally blown from the tree, and then must have come out on a root or jumped away from the tree somehow. No, that wasn't right. He'd read somewhere that lightning struck up, not down, moved from the ground up. Somehow it had come from the ground, through Derek and the radio and him to the tree, and then up, except that it seemed to come down, and Derek shouldn't have reached out, shouldn't have risen. He shook his head. Stupid. None of that mattered. Electrical shock. What did you do when there was electrical shock? CPR. To get them breathing again, you had to give them CPR. Except that Derek was breathing already. Heart. He should check the heart. He put his fingers on Derek's wrist, but couldn't find the pulse. But when he checked his own, he couldn't find that either. He put his ear to Derek's chest and heard the heart thumping. He tried to time it, but couldn't transpose the number of beats per minute measured on his digital watch into a pulse rate because he couldn't think. Think. The lightning came, took the tree, then Derek, the radio, him, and they were all knocked down and out. There it was. Maybe Derek was just knocked out and would come to in a little while. Somehow he knew that wasn't true. Something in the way Derek looked made the condition look like more than just being knocked out. Yet Brian wanted it to be so much that he forced himself to believe it. Derek was breathing evenly, short breaths, but even, and his heart was beating regularly. He was just knocked out. Brian would make him comfortable and then wait next to him, wait for him to come too. He would wait. The rest of that day and through the night, he kneeled next to Derek, waiting. He only moved to get a drink and eat some berries and go to the bathroom. The rest of the time, he kneeled next to Derek, putting a piece of wood on the fire now and then to keep it going, waiting, waiting. And he knew. He knew that Derek was not just unconscious, was more seriously hurt than that, and still he did not know what to do, or if he could do anything. The radio was gone. They had made a schedule that said they would check in once a week or so. It was very loose, and that they would call if there was an emergency. Derek had just done the weekly check-in the afternoon before, so they wouldn't think it odd that there were no calls. The Bush Plane headquarters said they would keep their radio on around the clock, but not necessarily manned all the time. So even if he had a radio, Brian might not be able to get them right away. Of course, he could call any other airplane and report the emergency, if he had a radio. So he could not call for help, and they would not worry for another week or so when Derek did not call in. There they were, where they sat. Derek was down, unconscious, in a coma. There. That word came. He had been afraid of the word death before, and now this word, coma. He'd have to stop that, have to face things better than he was facing them. He knew almost nothing of medical terms or what happened to people with severe shock, and knew less than nothing about comas. He'd seen movies about people in comas for months and months or years and years, and when they would suddenly snap out of it and wonder how long they'd been asleep. In the night next to Derek, he tried to will him awake. Snap awake now and ask how long you've been sleeping. Now, and we'll laugh and talk about how close the lightning came. But it did not work. Derek did not awaken, made no change of any kind. Somewhere just before dawn, when the first light of false dawn was making the western side of the lake come into view, Brian finally accepted it. Derek was in a coma and was apparently not going to snap out of it, at least not soon. That left everything, everything on Brian, and for a moment he felt a touch of anger and resentment. The woods, the damn woods. Last time he'd almost died, would have died except for luck, and now this again. All this dumped on him just because he'd tried to do the right thing, and he didn't even want to do it. Anyway, Derek was so dumb that he raised up and reached out when he should have stayed low and... Listen to me, he thought. If I were talking out loud, I'd be whining. Derek gets hit, and I act like I'm the one getting messed up. It was this way, he thought. Derek was unconscious, and it seemed to be a coma, or something like a coma. He did not seem to be coming out of it. The radio did not work, and Brian could not call for help. So then what? They might come looking in a week or 10 days. Could he stay here with Derek for a week or 10 days and wait for them? Could he not stay? What choices did he have? If he stayed and Derek didn't regain consciousness, how long would he last? If he didn't get food and water, could he stay alive? They never talked about that in movies or on television. They never said what they did with people in a coma. Fed them through tubes, probably. But he couldn't do that. He had to try to put food and water down Derek's throat, and if he did that, he might choke him and kill him. So he couldn't really do that either. So then, he said aloud, speaking to and not to Derek at the same time, "What can I do?" He had kneeled next to Derek almost all night, and when he tried to stand, his knees almost buckled. He rolled sideways and flexed his legs, and while he was rolled to the side, he smelled it. Oh, yes, I'd forgotten that kind of thing. The bathroom. Derek would, of course, have to go to the bathroom. His body functions would keep going. Or would they? Yes, apparently they would. There was that, too, to take care of Derek, truly take care of him. He'd never had to do anything like it before, take care of someone. Himself, sure, but he'd never been really responsible for some other person, and he wondered what to do, what a person did. The anger had passed, but he felt immense frustration at his helplessness. It had to be done. He had to clean Derek, take care of him, take care of another human being. Look at it that way, he thought, not Derek, but another person. He had to clean this helpless person. If he kept it detached, maybe he could do it. Why would it be so hard, anyway? He unfastened Derek's pants, and the smell grew stronger. Oh, God. He fought the nausea down, controlled it, turned Derek over and held his breath and used grass to clean him. Then he pulled the pants up and put him on his side again. Parents, how did parents do it? It was horrible. How could they do it? He used sticks to carry it in the grass to the hole they had dug for a bathroom and covered it with dirt, then went down to the lake and washed his hands again and again until he could hold them to his face and not smell anything. When they were clean and he could breathe normally without choking, he went back to Derek. Comfort. He could do what he could to make Derek more comfortable. Brian moved him and rearranged the pine boughs to make a softer bed. Then he pulled Derek onto his back on the new boughs, but was alarmed when Derek seemed to begin to choke or breathe strangely, and he put him back on his side. So nothing. Nothing he could do, not really. It was full light now, warm with the sun drying the rain off the grass. A warm summer morning with birds singing, Brian thought, looking across the mirrored surface of the lake. A beautiful summer morning with birds singing and fish jumping on the lake and everything perfect except for this one thing. This one little thing. Derek was in a coma. Somewhere, Brian thought, somewhere he'd heard something about comas. He must have, something more than he could remember. But it had to be in his mind, in his thinking, and if it was there, he must be able to get it out. He spent the morning trying to remember what he knew, but nothing came. It was like being asleep, except that you didn't wake up, he thought. Everything kept working, but you couldn't eat or drink. He had been moving from the lake to the shelter with a birch bark cone full of water when it hit him. They could wait all week, wait 9 or 10 days for the plane to come, or he could. He knew that people had gone that long without food. Derek would lose some weight, but he wouldn't starve to death in that time. But Brian was sure Derek could not go that long without water. 2, 3 days, maybe 4, then he would be in trouble. Somewhere he'd heard or read or seen that the human body couldn't go that long without water, and it had already been 1 day going on 2 days. He could try getting Derek to drink. If he could get water in him, he would last. His breathing had steadied still more, and his heart rate was close to normal. Brian had finally settled enough to measure it and calculate that it was running about 65 beats per minute. He remembered something about the rate supposing to be 72, so Derek was low, but it was still working all right. Brian made a small, spoon-like holder out of birch bark. With this, he dipped water from the cone, which he had propped next to Derek's head, and he put a small bit of water into the unconscious man's mouth. The effect was immediate and explosive. Derek choked instantly, and the reflex action took over, and he coughed, spraying water and spit in Brian's face. The choking continued, and Brian frantically pulled Derek's head over to the side, held his face down, and pounded on his back, all he knew to do. It seemed to last forever, and Brian was terrified that he'd killed Derek. One mistake, one thing wrong, and he was choking to death. But finally the water cleared from Derek's throat, and the coughing stopped, though his breathing was still ragged. So you can't drink. Brian settled Derek's head back onto the rolled-up jacket. That doesn't make all this any easier. At first he felt strange talking to Derek when there was no indication that he could be heard. Then he remembered his mother reading a story in a paper and telling him about a girl that had been in a coma for months. Please, he thought, dear God, don't let Derek be under that long. And when she recovered, she said that while she was in the coma, she could hear people talking. She could hear and understand, but could not answer, and he thought Derek might be the same. Derek? He leaned close to Derek's face. Can you hear me? There was no sign. Can you move your eyelids? If you hear me, move your eyelids. Nothing. The eyes were half opened, filled with tears that came constantly. Apparently the body was trying to keep them from drying out because Derek could not blink. He sat up, then stood and looked at the sky. I can't do this, he thought. I can't do this alone. I just can't. He looked down at Derek again, shook his head. I don't know what to do. And he realized then that he was wrong. It wasn't like last time. He wasn't alone. There was Derek. Maybe if he talked to him, spoke aloud to him, maybe it might help. Here it is, Brian said, squatting again, moving a stick in the dirt. There's no way anybody will come for at least a week and maybe longer, maybe 10 days. I don't think it would be good to go that long without water. I can't get you to drink because I think you'll choke, so, he repeated, shrugging, drawing a big zero in the dirt. I don't know what to do. He threw the stick down in exasperation. It hit the ground harder than he meant, then bounced and skipped into Derek's briefcase. Brian saw it as if for the first time. He'd forgotten about it in the crisis and went to it. What have you got in here? It was not locked, and he opened it with the two sliding thumb releases on either end of the handle edge. Inside there were spiral notebooks. They weren't anything special, the kind with ruled lines and the twisted wire holding the edge, and each of them was numbered. He opened number one. Arrived, he read aloud. Brian demanded that we leave all the gear in the plane or it would ruin the whole experiment. Oh, yes, Brian thought, I did that. Oh, God, I did that, didn't I? I stuck my little foot down and dug in and got stubborn and set all this up. What was there? Food and shelter and a gun and all the things I didn't think we'd need that would make this easier. I admire his ethics, he finished reading the first day. He put the notebook down. You do, eh? Admire me, the guy who made us lose all that gear? He felt like he was prying and decided not to read any more of the notebooks. He started to close the briefcase and saw that there was a folding accordion-style section that collapsed back into the lid. There was something in the section, and he pulled out a folded paper. When he opened it, he saw that it was the map, the same map they had looked at with Brian's mother. He saw the lake, saw where they had circled it with her, showing where they would be, how located it looked, how easy to see and find and locate. Derek had had two copies of the map, and he'd left one with Brian's mother. So you can always tell right where we are. Brian remembered sitting there, his mother smiling, all her questions answered, all her doubts gone. And now look at them. Derek had brought the other map and kept it when Brian dug his heels in and told him to send everything but the radio back. And in some relief, Brian had spread the map gratefully on the back of the briefcase, thinking it would help. But now he shook his head and started to fold it. What difference did it make if he knew where they were? It wouldn't help them. Then he looked at the lake again, saw how it lay in the wide, flat greenness, how there were many lakes around it. And he saw the river. He had noticed it before, of course, when they went over the map in his house and when they had first landed. But in the largeness of the country shown on the map, the massive forest the map showed, the river was a small thing, and he had negated it. It wound out the bottom of the lake, the southern end, and headed southeast down into the lakes below and was lost, and he had not followed it except to note the name, the Necktie River. Isn't that a funny name, his mother had said, and Derek had laughed. There are lakes named Eunice or Bootsock. There are so many lakes and rivers the original mapmakers just made up names as they went. The person drawing the map was probably wearing a tie and thought it would make a good name. Many of them aren't named at all, just numbered. The Necktie River, Brian saw, led south and down and drew his eyes away from the lake. The map was laid out in square 5,000-meter grids, 5-kilometer squares, and he saw that in some places the river wound back almost on itself inside the same 5,000 square meters, but in other places it ran straight for a considerable distance, and he followed it, through smaller lakes and what he thought must be swamps, through the darker green portions that meant heavier forest. It kept going south to the edge of the map where it was folded, and he unfolded the next section and spread it in the sun. He did not know why the river drew him, pulled at him. Then halfway through the second page he saw it. The river had grown all along, gotten wider so that it made a respectable blue cut across the map, and where it made a large bend, cutting back nearly straight east, there was a small circle drawn and the words, Brannock Trading Post. Leading away from Brannock's post, there was a double line heading down into the southwest. When he found the symbol for the double line on the map's legend, he saw that it stood for an improved gravel road. There would be people there. Right there, on the map, at Brannock's trading post, there would be people. They wouldn't have a road or name the place or make it a dot on the map unless there were people there. A trading post would have people. Which, Brian thought, doesn't mean a thing. He wasn't at Brannock's trading post. He was here. Yet he couldn't take his eyes off the spot on the map. It was there, on the same map, just there. And he refolded the map so it would show the lake where they were and the trading post at the same time. He used his fingers to make a divider and measured it straight down, but it didn't mean anything. Then he remembered that the grid stood for 5 kilometers each, and when he counted the number of grids between the lake and Brannock's, he came up with about 16 squares. "So how far is that?" he said to Derek. 5 times 16, maybe 80, 85 kilometers? But that was straight, in a straight line, southeast. The river was nowhere near straight, looping back and forth and actually flowing slightly north back along itself at one point. He started counting, measuring the river as it turned through each 5-kilometer square, marking each 10 kilometers in the dirt with a line through it, then the next set of 10. It was involved and took him some time, but finally he was done. He counted them. 150 kilometers, he said. 1.6 kilometers to a mile, just under 100 miles. He looked at Derek, who did not move, who made no sign. "There are people just under 100 miles from here. But what good did that do? Here it is. I could leave you and try to follow the river out and bring help back," which he thought sounded insane. There were animals. They would come, and if they thought Derek was dead, he was defenseless. They might attack him, even eat him, even small things, ants, bugs. "I can't leave you." Brian looked at the map again. It was there. The answer was there. Brannock's trading post was the answer, and the river was the answer, but he didn't see how. He couldn't leave Derek. He couldn't leave Derek. What if he took Derek with him? He said it aloud. "What if we went out together?" On the face of it, it sounded like madness. Haul a man in a coma nearly 100 miles out of the wilderness on a river? You could say that, Brian thought, but there was a lot of difference between saying it and doing it. How could he? The river. If he had a boat. Or a raft. If he made a raft and put Derek on the raft, there might be a way he could make the run and take Derek out, get him to the trading post and to help. And even as he said it, he knew it was crazy. 100 miles on a wilderness river with a raft hauling a grown man who would be nothing but dead weight was impossible. He would have dropped it, except that he looked up from the map and saw the truth then. Looked up and saw Derek with his eyes half open and not seeing, awake but not truly living, the minutes of his life moving past, and Brian knew that he really didn't have any choice. If he stayed, Derek would die of thirst in 2, perhaps 3 days. Well, before the week or 10 days that would pass before the pilot came looking to see what happened. If he stayed, Derek would die. If he made the run, took Derek down the river, at least there was a chance. He had no choice. Time was everything now. Once the decision was made, time was vital. But Brian took a minute to scan the map once more and do some mental calculating, and it didn't come up too terrible. Say it was 100 miles by river. When they'd landed, they'd come down next to where the river left the lake, and Brian had watched the current as it flowed away. It seemed to move about as fast as a person walked, maybe 3 miles an hour. Of course, that didn't mean that it would continue to flow at that speed, but it would probably be about the same. If he could get into the current and move with it and stay with it, 100 miles would take 35 or 40 hours. He studied it closer on the map and noted that it grew wider as it flowed and that in some places it moved through hilly country. There were contour lines on the map close together, which meant steeper hills. Here the current might even be a little faster. A day and a half, he thought. Then he said it aloud for Derek. A day and a half, a long day and a half, but if we keep moving, stay in the river and don't stop, we should make the trading post in a day and a half, maybe 2 days. And that, he thought without saying, is a lot better than 7 or 8, a lot better than dying. There were 2 places where the river ran into lakes and out the other end, and many smaller ponds in what might be swamps where the river moved through a center of a small body of water. They would slow him down. He could not judge how much, but none of them were large, and if he stayed on the edge and used a pole, he should be able to keep moving well enough not to lose too much time. Time. He was sitting, reading, looking at the map, and there wasn't time for it. He needed to build a raft. He checked Derek one more time, made certain his breathing was regular and that his heart was beating steadily, and then moved off down the side of the lake, looking for wood. The problem was not wood so much as the lack of a tool. When he'd made the raft before to go out to the plain, he'd had his hatchet, and he missed it terribly now. After he'd been rescued and gone home, his mother had put the hatchet in a glass case in the living room where she kept the china handed down by her grandmother. He'd looked at it as he'd left the house, but they had decided that having a hatchet might not be realistic. "Lots of people carry a knife of some kind," Derek had said, "but how many have a hatchet on their belt?" So all he had was a knife. Well, two knives, actually. He had Derek's knife as well. He'd almost forgotten that. But even two knives wouldn't help him cut through logs. There was wood all over the place. Windstorms over the years had knocked down pines and spruce trees, and many of them were the right diameter to use for making a raft, 6 or 8 inches and straight. But they were for the most part too long or still connected to the root structure, which made them impossible to use. But Brian moved along the lake, up from the shore and back, and finally he found a stand of large poplars where beavers had been working. He knew almost nothing of beavers except that they lived in the water, chewed trees down, and looked cute when he saw them swimming in the water. Except for pictures, he'd never seen one on dry land. But he'd seen how they took trees down, and this stand of poplars was a good example. In 100-yard circle, there wasn't a tree standing. There were pointed stumps everywhere with tooth marks on them, and dropped trees fallen across each other so thickly that it looked like giants had started to play pick-up sticks and walked away before finishing the game. The beavers had been working at the grove for some time, probably years, and they'd not only dropped the trees, many of them the right diameter, but they had cut the limbs off and dragged them down pathways to the lake and cut some of the tree trunks in sections between 8 and 10 or 12 feet long, apparently to make them easier to move. "It's like I hired them," Brian thought, looking at all the fallen poplars, "just to cut them down for me." The older trees, which had been cut down the year or two before, were well dried out, and when Brian rolled and skidded them down to the lake, he found that they floated well. 4 of them, side by side, held him up easily when he used his arms to hold them together and crawled on top of them. He got wet, but they held him. Of course, Derek was a lot heavier, and the 2 of them together heavier still, but 8 or 10 of them should do it. And there were many the right size and length. He had only to select the ones he wanted. He worked hard for a solid half hour, then ran to check on Derek. He was still the same, and Brian jogged back to the beaver's woodyard. He picked 8 logs, each running close to 8 inches thick and roughly 8 feet long. He selected the driest ones he could find, going by feel. He'd learned that from firewood. The drier, the lighter. The wood was soft, felt soft to the point of his knife, and he thought that might mean they would waterlog, but then he decided it wouldn't matter. It would take weeks or at least days to soak into an 8-inch log, and he wouldn't need the logs that long. One way or the other, he thought, while dragging the first log down to the lake. The beavers had left clear sliding trails where they had dragged branches down to the lake, and Brian used one of them, the main trail, to pull the logs down. The last 4 feet to the water were fairly steep, and the mud was slick from the recent rain, and the logs pretty much made their own way to the lake, pushing him ahead down into the water. He had a plan, or as much of a plan as he could have, for what he was going to try to do. He couldn't move Derek very far by mere strength. He had to weigh close to 180 pounds compared to Brian's 140. Brian couldn't carry him, and could only drag him a short distance. So he had to bring the raft to just below the shelter, bring the raft to Derek, and that meant building it here and working it up the side of the lake to Derek. It took him less than an hour to get all the logs down to the water, and when he lay them side by side and lined the ends together, he was pleased to see that they made a usable-looking raft. The ends weren't quite even, but close, and they were pointed the way the beavers had chewed them off. It gave them a streamlined look, like something out of Huckleberry Finn, he thought. Except that nothing held them together yet. Brian stood next to them in knee-deep water and studied the problem. He had no rope, no string, and yet he had to have a way to hold the logs in a flat platform to keep them solid enough to carry Derek and him. He had his clothing, his jacket, the same type windbreaker he'd had when he first had to survive after the plane crash, and he had Derek's jacket as well, though Brian wanted to keep that for cover for Derek. But even cutting the jackets in strips might not make enough roping to tie all the logs together. He cast around, half looking for vines or grasses he could weave into a rope. But again the beavers helped him. They had also cut smaller sticks, limbs, and the tops of the trees, some of them 5 or 6 feet long and 2 or 3 inches in diameter. They provided his answer. He made cross pieces with them, put one on top and one on the bottom, and sandwiched the raft body logs in place. Then he cut strips from his jacket and tied the 2 cross pieces together at the end so that they were pulled together and held the logs firmly in place. By using his knife to notch the cross pieces to take the material, he made sure the cloth tie-downs didn't slip off. He put 4 of these cross members down the length of the raft,